Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. And you're listening to New Books in Scholarly Communication. Today I'm speaking with Ian M. Cook, Editor-in-Chief of Allegra Lab. We're discussing his new book, Scholarly Podcasting, Why, What, How. This book features interviews with 101 podcasting academics. It's a fantastic resource and guide for those looking to bring their educational mission to a wider audience. Ian, thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Of course, you know, this is a book where it's almost, written exactly for our audience and for our hosts. So I think that this will be an interview that will be particularly useful for hosts and maybe, you know, more of like the NBN superfan type. But before jumping into the book, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a social anthropologist. This book was sort of an accident because really my at least initial research interest is like urban anthropology. Did a lot of research in South India and doing research in a smaller city called Mangaluru, looking at urban change and working a lot with door-to-door salespeople, rickshaw drivers, and housing and land brokers. And then after I did that, that was basically the PhD research. And after I finished that, I was, what you do when you finish the PhD, starting to apply for jobs. And I used to be a host of New Books Network. New Books Network, New Books in South Asian Studies from about 2015, I think, 15, 14. And I absolutely loved it. And then I started to think a little bit more seriously about how I could interrogate what I was doing with podcasting and what everybody else was doing with podcasting. And then so that's how sort of I took sort of a slight diversion, which was just like sort of a side hobby, side interest, like looking into scholarly podcasting, and then it became this book. That was like a good couple of years, and in the meantime I was working a lot with a wonderful program in Budapest called OLIVE, the Open Learning Initiative, which is a access education program for displaced people, so for mostly for refugees or asylum seekers. I don't know how much everyone listening knows about Hungary, but it's a pretty difficult place for people who are displaced because of the political situation here. So we thought it was very important to have university access for people there as well. So that was sort of my main sort of primary job for the last 4 years. And then very recently, I became, as you mentioned, editor-in-chief of Allegra Lab, which is an anthropology publishing platform.
So what was the main inspiration for you for writing this book about scholarly podcasting? And, you know, let's just start with a sort of overarching hope that you had for what readers might gain from it.
Right. So, I had three big questions, and you mentioned them. They were the title. They were like, what is academic podcasting? Like, why do scholars podcast? And how? And because I'm an anthropologist, I always feel like I need to do something a bit ethnographic to answer any question. So this is why I went about interviewing 101 people. 101 was just the number that I stopped at. It wasn't the target. And I wanted to find out what this about this phenomena, because more and more scholars were podcasting. I mean, New Books Network was a pioneer, but there were plenty of other people starting and trying different things, and it just keeps growing and growing. And whenever you see a phenomena as a social scientist, you start to ask these questions like why, what, and how. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to find a way of representing the diversity of scholarly podcasting and to allow those who podcast to speak about what they were doing, how they were doing it, and why they were doing it, which is why the book, I mean, sometimes I say I wrote a book, but I wrote very little of the book, you know, as you've read it, but most of the book is just quotes. Basically 90% of the material in the book is just quotations from the people I interviewed, because as you might imagine, scholars who make podcasts are pretty good at talking, and so often they were saying things in ways that were super articulate and erudite. And when I started to do the sort of regular social science thing, like write around it and then, you know, make an argument, have a quote, back it up, it felt really disjointed and a little bit cold. So I was like, okay, let's instead sort of curate these quotes and create a book from which people can draw different strands of inspiration depending on what they wanted to do with a scholarly podcast. Because of course, as you know, there's a podcast like the one we're doing now, which is a discussion, you know, based podcast. There's ones which are more sort of crafted audio storytelling. There's some that are more, you know, group discussion, and there's some that are more, you know, experimental and playing with sound to try and affect certain resonances with their listeners. So there's many different ways in which you can do a scholarly podcast. And of course, there's as many disciplines within the scholarly podcasting world as there is, you know, disciplines in scholarship in general. So I wanted to have a book that wasn't like this sort of really strong, like straight argument, which is often what we're made to do when we produce written scholarship. Instead, I wanted to have this book that you could sort of dip in and out of and try to understand from the perspective of the podcasters what it was they're doing and why they're doing it.
So you mentioned that you started with New Books Network in about 2015. So you've been doing scholarly podcasting for quite some time. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what you've seen from podcasts, you know, how it's evolved and changed in that period, and also just where you see it like evolving in the future, and what role you see it as playing in, you know, just increasingly playing in the academic community at large.
Yeah. Unsurprisingly, as somebody who makes a podcast and as somebody who wrote a book about podcasting, I think it's super exciting. I think it's brilliant. I think there is the potential to really liberate knowledge in many different ways. There are worries, and I'll talk about the worries in a minute, but before I get there, maybe just to say what's great about it. I mean, I think New Books Network is an amazing resource. Let's be honest, most of the books that are featured on the different channels of New Book Network, you will never have the time to read. You know, like somebody could have a super interesting book about a very niche topic, which I don't have 2 weeks to sit down and read, but I do have 45 minutes or an hour to sit and listen to a conversation with someone. And that's brilliant. That's like really like opening up knowledge in and exposing people to knowledge that they otherwise wouldn't get. Even if you're an academic, you have very little time to read outside your hyper specialized field, right? And I'm a, you know, urban anthropologist, South Asia, I read stuff in that field. I don't read much other anthropology unless it's directly related to what I'm teaching or what I'm working on. I don't read much of a, you know, scholarship from adjacent fields, sociology or history or whatever, if it's not directly related to what I'm working on, but I'm fascinated by stuff and I want to be curious. And I think a lot of curiosity is beaten out of us once we start working full-time in academia, and also maybe as students, the longer you stay in university as well. So I think what's been really interesting to see is that it's been, and this came through for the interviews, it's been very liberating for the scholars who make podcasts, because they've been like, okay, wow, I'm free from, and this is maybe the going into a bit the fears, I'm free from these academic rules and norms and structures. You know, you should write a journal article of this many words, submit it to a journal of a certain rank so your university can give it a certain point so you can progress a certain way in your career. Like, if that was my sole means of intellectual output, I wouldn't stay in academia. Like, I just, for me, it just seems stupid. Like, just completely stupid. And but podcasting really opens up ways, different ways of interrogating ideas, different ways of producing and creating knowledge, and different ways of circulating that knowledge. And what I've seen in the last years is that more and more people have been inspired by it and are trying it. And at the same time, is some people are trying to play it or use it maybe for their personal prestige, or maybe playing that same system as well. And I think that's the fear, that it could get pulled into the scholarly publishing machine that sort of that goes on. But I still think there's a lot of hope there, a lot of potential for creating something which is genuinely transformative, potentially in academia and scholarship more broadly.
How do you think academics should balance the demand for creating engaging content and then also just appealing to a broader audience and doing all this while trying to maintain scholarly rigor?
Yeah. Well, it depends what your purpose is with the podcast, right? If the purpose and who your audience is. So if your audience is other experts in the field that you're working on, then you might want something which only speaks to those scholars. And that might be something which is, which doesn't have a broad appeal. And that's totally fine, because that's maybe you're not making a podcast to have a broad appeal. Maybe you're making a podcast to have a quick means of, you know, circulating the freshest ideas in your field with your peers. And that's totally fine. If you want to go broader, then you have to start to think about who your audience is, what sort of language you want to use, how much you need to explain stuff. And in the book, like, you can see a big sort of a broad range. Some people really are making hyper specialized podcasts, you know, about, environmental justice amongst the, I might get this wrong now, but the Swedish speaking minority, like in wherever. And another people are making a podcast about the Naked Scientist with Chris Smith. He's making a podcast which you know, he also gets on the radio as well, you know, in the UK, or he also speaks on the radio and stuff. And he's making a super popular podcast. And then he's thinking very much about that audience. So that really depends. In terms of scholarly rigor, I think, again, it depends on who the peers are for your podcast and how you would like that to be evaluated. I think we all know, any of us who published anything in academia, that the processes of peer review, which are meant to be put in place to protect rigor, often fail. They fail because people practice a certain form of cruelty through peer review, unfortunately, or they fail because it takes years to get a review, or because people just play the game and publish the same article 10 times in 10 different journals just to get points and so on and so forth. Something quite different happens with a podcast, especially when it's not really being ranked, because it just goes out there in the world. And let's say, for example, you know, like, you make this podcast today and you say something which is incorrect, and then you could be like, okay, next episode of the podcast, if it's a serialized podcast, you just issue a correction. So, you know what, guys, last time I said the tallest mountain in the world was Mount Blanc, but I was wrong. It's, you know, whatever. And then, you know, and get on with it. And it's a different way of interacting with knowledge and how it's being assessed.
How should scholars think about collaboration with researchers to create compelling podcasts? And, you know, what are some of the best practices that you've seen that experts have taken in the field of podcasting?
Ooh, that's a great question. So I think it has to start with respecting, understanding, and working with the craft of podcasting. I mean, like, the final chapter of the book is about that. It's about thinking through what you have when you start to work with the medium and how you can convey those ideas. So the worst thing you can do probably is print off a paper, read it very quickly into a microphone, and put it out there in the world. and like, unfortunately, some people make these podcasts, or some people, they make these very sort of awkward conversations that sound like, I don't know, they sound like no one's really enjoying themselves and no one really is comfortable. And that doesn't seem to suit the medium very well either. right? I'm not sure it necessarily suits the sort of pretend conversation that you have on stage, you know, at some conferences. It certainly doesn't suit the podcasting medium. People don't seem to want to consume that sort of content. So what it means, first of all, I would say, is to have an idea which suits the medium, right? So for example, there was a podcast that featured a book called My Favorite Theorem, which is a maths podcast. And you would think about maths, usually it's something which is quite visual, right? They write on blackboards, or they write on bits of paper, and this is how they work stuff out. But then that's not going to work as a podcast, like that sort of stuff. But what works as a podcast is having mathematicians talk about their love for certain theorems, and then you get this emotional aspect there instead. So you have to think, okay, does my idea suit podcasting? If not, then it's great. Go make a flowchart, go make whatever suits the medium, right? And then after that, I would listen to a lot of podcasts. Then I would think about how, and this is also like what I got from speaking to people, you also want to think about how to structure it. You also want to, because I think written work and audio work are quite different in terms of how you have to guide a listener through. So a conversation like we're having now is relatively natural and people can listen to that. If you had like just somebody talking, you might need to have more signposts along the way to let people know where they're going. Like the way you've written your questions that you're asking me now, we're getting a bit meta. You've not written them in the same way as if you were writing a written request for somebody to ask. You know, you've written them in a conversational style. That's also something to learn as well, to learn how to write for the ear and not for the eye. Then you need to think a little bit about, I say a little bit about recording and the technical side. As you know yourself, it's not super complicated. It's rather just paying attention to some basic things, just to be in a quiet room, use headphones and know where the microphone is placed and how close you should be to it. But that's still important to think about. And then to learn a bit about editing as well, which is, I think, really important. So I know some podcasters don't edit, and I think you can... I mean, they don't edit themselves. Sometimes they hire a student to edit their stuff for them or whatever. But I think everyone should edit at least one or two of their own podcasts if they're doing an interview style podcast, because then they realize how they ask questions, how they pause, how they speak, and so on. And then again, to think about your audience when you want to distribute it and so on. And this sounds like quite a daunting prospect, but I would say that's the same sort of things you have to follow whatever form of scholarly media you're producing, whether it's text or audio or film. You need to think about all of these aspects, like running through the whole thing in different ways.
Yeah, following up on some of those things that that should be considered before starting, I'm wondering, what are some of the unique challenges that come with producing podcasts about academic research and scholarship? Are there any additional things that a person should consider before covering something?
Just to answer the same way I did the previous question, it's about thinking about the medium. And otherwise, there are things that change when you work with a publicly available piece of scholarship. If you're doing something where you're actually, for in the social sciences, for example, if you're producing a podcast when you're speaking with somebody who is an interlocutor or informant or interviewee, there are different ethical considerations there. Sometimes I think, because some of the podcasters interviewed for the book made podcasts like this, they were basically data collection and podcasts at the same time. I think, to be honest, often it's a little bit more honest than the way that social scientists usually do research, because often you have like a ethical review board at the university and they sign off on stuff, and you're meant to make people sign like that they understand what happens with their the data that you're gathering from them. But very often that consent isn't properly informed, because people don't really genuinely understand what happens with that, like in an academic setting. Certainly not if you work amongst people who are illiterate or semi-literate, or maybe haven't been exposed to the way scholars deal with data. But a podcast, especially nowadays, like any form of digital media, people sort of understand what happens. So if you're interviewing somebody and you tell them, listen, I'm interviewing you for my research, I'm also going to make a podcast out of this, then people are fully aware what it means now. Not fully aware, I should say. People are more aware than they might be of a traditional type of research of what happens to your voice or if it's being filmed, the video, once it starts to circulate within, within digital media things.
So let's talk a little bit about not just, you know, doing the podcast itself, but just podcasting as a part of the broader academic setting. So how can podcasting be used as a tool for teaching and learning in the academic setting? And what are some of the best practices that you've seen for incorporating podcasts into the classroom or just any sort of educational environment?
Yeah, there's loads of options. I've spoken to people who have their students, and I've also done this myself, make podcasts as assignments, which is great. And there's lots of options there as well. So for example, instead of writing a term paper, you could say, okay, make a podcast on this topic. And, you know, then they would go out, they would interview somebody, they would do a bit of framing around it. And the student then is learning research skills, interview skills, time management skills. They're also then having to really think carefully about the questions that they ask. And that means they're really interrogating the topics of the class in different ways. And then because they're producing something public, then usually they'll take it more seriously than what they would if they just wrote an essay for their professor or lecturer. That's one way. Another way is you could use it as a teacher. You can basically make podcasts on the topic of your class as a teacher as well. If you're working in a field where it's fast moving. I spoke to a scholar who works in the field of energy, and he was saying, yeah, you know, like the amount of time it takes for something to come out in a peer-reviewed journal, the field has moved on so fast, you know? And so, but he can interview practitioners in the field and he can share this podcast with the students. The students then can get a good feeling. And of course, it's not realistic that you can bring in all these experts into the classroom. And they might not want to do that, but they might give their time for a podcast and they can sort of promote themselves or whatever. Or it's also, you know, that people like to feel that they're experts. And then this can also be another way you use it. Other people have just assigned podcasts as listenings to go alongside readings. That's super useful and super great. And then I also really like people who have decided to make collaborative podcasts with the students in their class. And you know, different people take on different roles within a podcast series. Maybe someone's doing the research, someone's doing the interviews, someone's doing the editing, and then you really work together with the teacher to produce something together. And it's a really powerful way of using podcasting as well.
And I should also mention that in the back of the book, you do have a resource that kind of outlines like a potential schedule that a teacher could use. In addition to that, another resource you have, you just have a list of the 101 people that you interviewed. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, some of those interviews. I should also note that there are, you interviewed two people as being directly associated with New Books Network. There's another host who hosts a podcast called Democracy Works, who also does some work with the New Books Network that you also interviewed. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of those interviews and, you know, what you learned, if there was any patterns that you saw or anyone that was, had some ideas or suggestions that you thought were really fascinating.
Yeah, so it was quite an eye-opener for me how many people responded. So as I mentioned, like sort of my previous research project, when I was, you know, sitting on rickshaw stands in an Indian city, like struggling to learn a language, trying to fit in with certain sort of macho culture and like, you know, and then to slowly build up trust and get interviews. And I was imagining I might have to do something similar-ish with this project, in the sense, you know, maybe reach out to people on social media, you know, start to like some of their episodes, comment on them, build up a relationship, and then you know, ask for interviews. But actually what happened was, and I did listen to all of the podcasts that I feature in the book, but I started just sending out emails and putting stuff on social media, and people just said, hey, yeah, I'd be really happy to talk about that. And the cynic could say, you know, academics like talking about themselves, but I think the more interesting thing is that doing a podcast is quite a reflexive process. So when you start to do it, you start to think about it, which is actually why I made the book in the end, because I started to think about it by doing it. After we've made this podcast today, I imagine you're going to listen back to it and maybe cut bits out or edit stuff. I don't know. And then you start to then think, oh, you know what? I wish I'd asked that question a different way. Oh, you know, it wasn't interesting that when I asked that question, he didn't quite answer it. You start to think like this, and it's really great, I think, in terms of making yourself think about the processes that you produce. And also it's also a very weird and wonderful thing when you do make a podcast and you put it out in the world and people respond to it, you know, which is not usually the place unless you're a superstar academic. You know, I write a research paper, it goes in a journal, maybe I like tell people about it, and then people might like it on Facebook if I put it on Facebook, but no one's really, you know, interacting with it. But people do interact with a podcast, and I think this also causes self-reflection on the side of the people I interview. So then, anyway, so that's all the preamble to say I just started interviewing people. And of course, because of my networks, I got more people in certain fields. Then I started to push out to say, okay, I've not really got anyone in the natural sciences, so let's find a biologist, let's find a virologist, you know, and reach out. And of course, you know, I'm limited by language as well, and this podcast in every possible language. And so, you know, I started to do that, and then I would basically have Zoom interviews with people. And this was mostly during lockdown, the first lockdown. So this was sort of my lockdown interview series. So, you know, I had the family all trapped in at home, and then every now and again, I would just like disappear into the bedroom and then interview someone. And what was, I say, so many interesting things came out. But I think, I would like to think that most people enjoyed the process of talking through these things and pushing them to think about stuff which was sort of bubbling away in their minds that they hadn't thought about before. And I used to, of course, it was a semi-structured interview, so I had a certain, you know, set of questions, and then this developed along the way. And then only when I got to the end, then I started interview not only scholars who make podcasts, but scholars of podcasting, media studies scholars as well, to try and think through some of these questions with them. And their interviews are also featured in the book as well, sort of as a way of doing some sort of theoretical-ish or analytical framing to the interviews themselves. Did I answer your question,
Kirby? Yeah, absolutely. You know, I guess I think for podcast listeners, oftentimes they're, like for me personally, I first sort of discovered podcasting, I guess probably when I was, you know, in high school, and it was this really exciting thing. One of the people you interviewed, Dan Carlin, Hardcore History, which is, I think, kind of in the history podcasting world, he's a bit of a legend. And it was just this really exciting way to learn about things that I didn't get to learn about in the classroom in a fun and an engaging way, especially because I had, you know, long bus rides to and from school. It was sort of perfect for that. So, you know, with that, I'm wondering, is there a particular podcast that you listen to where that sort of, you know, sent you down this path, that you listen to it and you're like, yes, that's like what I want to be doing. I want a podcast because, you know, it will allow me to do something sort of like what this person did.
That's a good question. Before that, I just want to reflect a little bit about interviewing Dan Carlin. So, like, of course, he's a, you know, podcasting superstar. So usually it's always difficult with time zones, right? But the only time he was available was something stupid like 3 o'clock in the morning. So I said, okay, like, I'll interview him at 3 o'clock in the morning. But the problem with interviewing somebody who's interviewed a lot is that he has a set stock of stories that he tells. And which is fine because, you know, people, whatever. So I watched a bunch of his interviews or listened to a bunch of his interviews before. And then I knew he had this story about when, you know, his mother-in-law told him he should make a podcast or something like this. And I was like, oh, so I was always like, I know your mother-in-law told you to make a podcast, but like, can we, and then, but then he still told the same story. And then I had to push him a bit more. But actually, if you, what was interesting in terms of how he produces the podcast, because he makes like 5-hour long podcasts, right? Like about whatever topic. And he just goes in and records his voice, like maybe just like 2 minutes one day, 10 minutes the next day, half an hour the next day, you know, and then one time it's not working. So he's someone who really thinks about the craft. So I think you can learn a lot from listening to people like him in terms of he's thinking about the craft of how it is to talk, right? He doesn't think of himself really as a scholar. I think he's got like a master's in history. So he's always a bit like, oh, I'm not really a historian. I would say he is. He's, you know, a popular historian. Like, you don't have to have a PhD to be a scholar. But so it was interesting that for him, he was always a bit like, but then he was thinking a lot about the delivery, which most of us don't as scholars, because we're thinking all about the content, but we're working with a medium, even if it's text or if it's sound, where of course it's key how we express our ideas. So, so I would say in terms of like podcasters who make who sort of podcasting that's inspirational, I probably have less from the scholars themselves, but more from stuff outside. What I would like to do and what I'm planning to do if I have time over summer, I got a bunch of recordings from when I was doing ethnographic fieldwork, and I want to try and create something more like a crafted audio story. And let's see how it works, because sometimes it's hard to find a story, right? To be a storyteller as well as a scholar, but that's probably what I would aim for in the future. And yeah, I used to love, sorry.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I was going to say, like, I think that that's a great idea. You know, I, you know, audiobook, the history of audiobooks only, you know, it, or in the current form, at least, only really predate podcasts by a few years. And I've always wondered, you know, why there isn't more done, like you said, you know, you can just go and read the book, why there isn't more done to just bring in other things like interviews or things like that to just make it even more engaging, and, you know, just different ways to communicate the information. I think that that's really true.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. And I think that's what's going to open. And I think the only thing that's really holding this back is the sort of the ways in which scholars are asked to produce scholarship to get jobs, get promotions, and so on and so forth, is basically, it's a disincentive to spend a lot of time. It would take a lot of time to produce this sort of content that doesn't, I'm doing the square quotes now, count for anything, right? Because it doesn't count within the system of scholarly production. But it would take eight, I mean, this is why I've been putting it off for so long. It takes ages to produce something like that, partly because you have to learn a new skill as well. Whereas like the same way that like a student, by the time they become a PhD, could probably knock out a term paper quite easily if they needed to. Like at the same time, the longer you stay in academia, you can write a journal article, maybe not the best journal article in the world, but you can write a journal article if you need to send it somewhere, or a chapter for a book. But what's the point after a while? Like, I, you know, so it should be, it should, we should be pushing forward, yeah, to try and find new ways of producing, yeah, scholarship. And I think there was somebody in the book who was talking about exactly how if an idea can't, if an academic text or an academic idea can't be understood by a relatively intelligent, educated person who's in a different field, then it's, he somehow feels it has less worth, because it's like it's probably hidden behind a bunch of jargon and pretense, et cetera, and so on. You know, so like if I'm an anthropologist and I'm explaining about certain things about, you know, interactions between door-to-door sellers and their customers, and it's, you know, these questions of caste and gender norms and like rural, you know, urban migration and the symbolic role of the certain goods that are being sold, if I can't explain that to somebody in a way that they can understand it, because I have to put a bunch of words together that hide stuff, that I think it's a problem. And so so I really want to think about how, like you say, to use interview to think about like the affective nature of sound and how that can create certain responses from listeners to try and make an argument in that sense. So that's the future, that's my plan, that's my next 6 or 7 months, I think.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. You know, I also think it's so important too, just the accessibility aspect of it, because there are so many people out there that work jobs that they don't particularly like, or they work jobs, you know, maybe they, you know, drive trucks, or they, you know, do gig work of some kind. And, you know, the ability to learn while you do something else, like you can't read a book on the job, but you can listen to something. And that's a major difference, you know, and we've, you know, New Books Net, we've gotten feedback from listeners who are like, this is great because it helps me get through my job.
Yeah. And I think, you know, founder of New Books Network, Marshall Poe, who's interviewing the book, he talks about, I don't know if I included in the book now or not, but when I interviewed him, he spoke about how yeah, he was getting feedback from, like, you know, people who were like, I don't know, is it like shearing sheep in New Zealand, or like, you know, or driving or doing being an electrician in Denmark or something. And they're like, hey, like, thanks so much for putting this out. You know, this is just great. And I think there's a certain snobbishness that sometimes people get who work in academia, thinking, oh, you know, people couldn't possibly be interested in this, like, very sort of sophisticated stuff. Actually, it's, of course they are. Like, people are genuinely curious until society beats it out of them. And, like, this is what's so interesting about podcasting, is that it's actually shown that it's not just, like, people are actually really hungry and thirsty for listening to experts deep dive into a topic, which is brilliant. Like, you know, I mean, isn't it great? You can just, like, put on a podcast and listen to something you knew nothing about and hear, like, some of the leading people in the world talk about it for an hour. Like, that's brilliant. That's, like, absolutely amazing. And that was not available to us 10 years ago, like, or just about starting to become available to us 10 years ago. But before that, yeah, it was hidden. It was locked. So
yeah, it's certainly not the breadth of content that there is now, or the audio quality.
Well, that, like, as well.
Yeah, the audio quality has really drastically improved the past couple of years. Like, one maybe silver lining of the pandemic was that because so many people moved to work from home, everyone started to think more about what their home audio setup looked like. And that's a big, big deal. Like, if you listen to some of the older New Books Network episodes, you know, some of the hosts have good mics, but the guests, no, not so much.
Yeah. So I remember one I made, I won't mention the name, but, like, it was some guy, and it's like, you know, you know, because you send it to people, hey, make sure you're in a quiet room, please use headphones. Like, if you have a mic, use a mic. And some guy, like, yeah, I'm in a cafe. And it's just like, you're in a cafe? Yeah, and I haven't got a headphones. It's like, like, okay, great. It's like, so I've read your book. We're going to spend now, like, you know, 45 minutes talking about it, and no one's going to listen to it because all they hear is just, like, background clatter. So, yeah, but yeah, it's got much better. People have become, yeah, I agree with you. People have become much more attentive to that.
Right. Yeah, that's really funny. Well, Ian, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network and for being a, you know, a host alum. You know, I think when someone has been a host in the past for New Books Network, you know, we like to think of them as always being a part of the New Books Network family.
That's great.
Yeah, the book is Scholarly Podcasting: Why, What, How. And, you know, I think especially for any host listening or anyone who scholars out there that want to learn, this is a really great place to start. Because I think that, you know, there's one thing to just go and, like, listen to a few, but this is really tailored. So if you want to know what your colleagues are doing or what they're thinking about podcasting, this is a really great place to go, and also a great resource for teachers. So Ian, thank you so much.
Thank you. Absolute pleasure. I've been making podcasts for New Books Network now. I'm so happy to be a host, to be a guest. I couldn't even step out of it. Happy now to be a guest after being a host for so long.